everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Do you like to host parties, dinner parties, or events with food? We've done many and in our home, and sometimes in other people's homes as well. There are many ways to go. You can buy bags of chips, snacks, sodas, and booze, and bam, you are done. Get paper plates and cups, napkins, maybe. And that's easy. Or you might bring it up a notch and buy prepared foods at a supermarket or a food store. Or you can get it catered by a restaurant or caterer. Or you could make the food yourself. And guess what I'm going to talk about today? Sure, I'm going to talk about making some foods for a party yourself, but I'm also going to talk about some of the things that you can buy in a store. I mentioned a while back, my dad passed in November, and we had an unveiling for him this weekend. Now, I have mentioned before on this program that I have been raised Jewish, although today I am not a religious person. I do not practice. What I practice is veganism. That's my religion. But my family does have events that are related to some of the traditions. One of the traditions is called an unveiling, and when someone dies and is buried in a cemetery, you need to wait a period of time within a year before you place a grave marker, a headstone, a tombstone, whatever it may be, and you are not supposed to visit the cemetery until the grave marker is in place and you have this ceremony called the unveiling. So we just did that. And it's an interesting sort of thing. And of course, there's a lot of memories and emotions that come up during an event like this. And you may also be aware or not that in the Jewish religion, rather than bringing flowers to a grave, which are temporary and can dry up and become not very attractive or useful, what the Jewish people do is leave a stone or a pebble, something that can rest on the stone and have the weight there so that it's obvious that someone has visited. And then I also heard the idea that as the gravestone wears away, the pebbles and the stones on top will kind of grow it or add to it. Whatever. Traditions are traditions. And instead of stones, I have a collection of heart-shaped glasses, just pieces of glass that are shaped in hearts. And people give them to me from time to time. I really don't like collecting things, but somehow when I mentioned that I do have a few of these, because my last name is Hartglass, so I like to have these little glass-shaped hearts, I've collected a few of them. I took a small one, and that's what I brought to place on the stone. And my dad was a big bowler. He loved bowling. He bowled most of his life. He took a period of time off as he got older, and then he got back to it, which was amazing. And he bowled his highest score, 286, I think when he was about 80 or somewhere between 80 and 85. Anyway, my sister brought these little bowling pins and little bowling balls, and we actually stuck them in around the stone to show that we were there. It's kind of silly and sweet. And then afterwards, everyone that came to this event was invited back to my mom's house. Now, my mom's been stressing about people coming over to her home. She used to be really great at having parties, but she's going to be 85 next week, and it's difficult for her. She has memory issues and doesn't drive, and it's hard for her. So she just couldn't conceive of how she could entertain people, especially the way she used to. And I kept reminding her, don't worry, it's taken care of. I'm going to do it. And fortunately, it's relatively easy for me, and I have my partner Gary, and together, the two of us, we're really a great team. Somehow she had doubts, and now in hindsight, I'm realizing what some of her doubts were. I think she was concerned that I would only make vegan foods, and she wanted to make sure that for her and her friends there would be the traditional foods that she liked. And there were. One of her neighbors volunteered to pick up a platter of the quote traditional foods, which consist of bagels, white flour bagels, of course, and the traditional schmears, egg salad, tuna salad, salmon salad. My mom also wanted white fish salad, but for some reason she forgot to order it. She seemed a little disappointed. But the platter arrived, and something that always just makes me smile in an odd way is the garnish on these platters is typically kale. Of course, nobody will eat the kale. It's a garnish. And that's such an odd and funny thing because I can't live without kale. Now, I wouldn't necessarily eat the kale that they put on that platter as a garnish because it wasn't organic and who knows what they did with it. But it does make a nice garnish because it's so hearty and it doesn't wilt very easily. That's kale. So we had a platter like that, but I wanted to make the bulk of the food at this event, and I wanted it to be food that I liked, food that I thought everyone else would like, or at least be curious about. And I wanted to talk about some of the dishes that we made. So to start with, yes, there was a kale salad. We came up with a recipe a few years ago for the Food Revolution Network Summit, and I called it the Global Community Salad. Have you ever tried it? It's on our website at responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's a great salad, and I had created it in honor of the speakers of that day, kind of combining tropical fruits that came from other countries with things that came from kind of around the world. And in addition, the kale is prominent, but its flavor is not. It's mellowed with fresh mint, which really does an amazing job at blending with the kale and kind of taking away the bitterness and the strong flavor of the kale. Have you ever tried kale salad with a lot of mint in it? If you don't like kale and you want to learn how to like it, this might be a good way to do it. I had forgotten about this salad and I decided to make it for this event, and I was really delighted. I mean, I love the taste of kale, but when I bit into the blend of flavors, and I'll tell you what's in it in a moment, the mint was really the magical part of it. And I had gotten all the ingredients, and mint was the last thing. I couldn't find it in the store that I did the bulk of shopping in, so I had to actually pick it up a day later, and I was almost thinking of leaving it out, and I'm glad that I didn't. So the salad itself is simple. It's made of kale, which is finely chopped. What we recommend is putting it in a food processor and gently pulsing it a few times so that the pieces are small. It's not minced so that it's like a pulp, but it's small pieces. And using a food processor is a lot easier rather than chopping it yourself, although you could. And then I add to that organic corn. I always use frozen corn because it's easier. And some of them are really sweet and fantastic, the organic frozen corns. It had sunflower seeds in it too. And those were the ingredients of the salad. Sometimes I add chopped bell pepper to it too, but I didn't this time. Now, the key to this salad is the papaya avocado salsa. And I was a little concerned because I was making the dish the day before, and I knew that the avocado was going to be in this salad, but avocado can turn brown when you open it up and you cut it up and you don't eat it right away. But I decided to do it anyway, and it was amazing how it worked out. So the salsa has papaya, avocado, red onion, mint, and cilantro. And if for some reason you cannot eat cilantro or you don't like it, you don't have to use it. You can use parsley instead or leave it out. It's got a lot of lime juice in it too. And once I made the salsa and once I chopped the kale and mixed it with the corn and the sunflower seeds, then I mixed the whole salad together. And kale is a hearty leaf, and you can make this salad even dressed like this, and it will last several days perfectly. And it was wonderful for the event. The avocado actually just kind of melted and just made this lovely creaminess. It's a great salad. Please, if you have the chance and you're not really fond of kale, or maybe you're curious about kale, this is a salad worth investigating and investing in. It takes a little time, but it's really worth it. And if you make a lot, you can have it over a few days. But you don't have to make a lot. I think I made a double portion, but make a single portion, because if you don't like it, you don't want to have all of this left over, unless you know someone who really loves kale. Okay, so that's the global community salad. The next thing I wanted to make, and I really wanted to try this because I had never made it, was a purple potato salad. I think I mentioned it a few weeks ago where we were at Veggie Grill in California, and they have a summer celebration salad, and they had a purple potato salad on it, and I said I was going to make it. Well, I did. I have not posted this recipe because I am offering it to a new cookbook that will be coming out, and when it comes out, I'll let you know about it. It's a very simple recipe. But the key ingredient, of course, is purple potatoes, and we love purple potatoes because they have that purple color. The flesh is purple, and purple means it has wonderful anthocyanins in it, which have great anti-cancer properties. And I like them. So I made this purple potato salad. It's really fantastic. It's got vinegar and dill in it and no oil. And when I put it out on the table, it got a lot of attention because people aren't used to seeing purple foods or mashed purple foods, and no one knew what it was. I said it was purple potato salad. What? Purple potato salad? But everyone really loved it. The next dish we made was a sweet potato three bean salad. And again, this is a recipe that's at responsibleeatingandliving.com. I call it the sweet potato black bean salad, and it has garbanzo beans in it, but I made a three bean version because I had a bunch of azuki beans already made, and I thought it would be nice to make it a three bean salad because three bean salads are pretty popular for picnics and potlucks and things. But adding sweet potatoes to it and tossing it with a tahini dressing is the magic. This is a great dish. Everyone really loved it. And what surprised me is, since we had a bunch left over and we took it home, it makes a great breakfast. It's a great breakfast because, I don't know about you, but in the morning, I've been raised to eat cereal, and very often we have cereal with fruits and nuts, but it's on the sweet side. Sometimes I save the savory breakfast for the weekend. It's funny how we've been kind of trained and manipulated to like certain things, but it's sweet food during the week and then a savory, hearty breakfast sometimes as a brunch on the weekends. But this is a nice mix because beans are full of protein and resistant starch, and they're very satisfying and they're very good for you. And the sweet potatoes give it a nice sweetness, and the tahini dressing gives it this richness. I really recommend it for a breakfast and actually for any time of the day. It's funny because I was visiting with a friend of mine. She lives in Brooklyn, but she's been living in Paris for a few years working on her singing career. And she was back in Brooklyn, and we got together last week. We stopped for a little bite at a place called the Punchline Juice Bar. It's a little Rastafarian place, and they have vegan burgers and juices and smoothies. And I was really kind of curious to check it out. And we ordered some stuff. And I'm going to post what I had at this place on my daily blog, but I'll tell you, I'm a little late in posting my daily blog because I'm having computer issues. Boo-hoo. I've talked about my computer issues for a long time. You know, I keep going from one subject to another, and I'm going to get back to my original subject in a moment. But I have a 2011 MacBook Pro, and I'm really trying to keep it alive. And right now I'm working on Gary's computer because my MacBook Pro has died again. And I want to keep it going. I have a relationship with this machine, and also I'm very aware of the environmental impact that our phones and computers have, and I'm really trying not to support this throw it away, upgrade quickly kind of concept. If I can get this machine to keep going for as long as possible, I will. Right now I've got a logic board challenge and I'll get it going soon, but it's been a little difficult to keep up with my regular work. Anyway, you'll read about the punchline and what I had there soon. I had a black bean burger and some green juice. But when we were there, my friend was telling me about the things she does now and what she eats when she's in Paris. And some of these things are from what I had told her. And she was reminding me of the things that I had told her, and I have no recollection of this, but then I talk about food all the time, and when people tell me I've told them these things, well, I guess I have. But she was wondering at one point what to eat for breakfast, and I had mentioned that you can eat a salad for breakfast, and she was kind of shocked at the moment. Salad for breakfast? And then I said, well, why not? Why not? It's satisfying, and it doesn't put on a lot of weight, and you get a lot of nutrition from it, and why not have a salad for breakfast? There are other cultures that have salads for breakfast. You could really have any food you want at any time of the day, whatever suits you, but we have these traditions in our cultures about what we have. People eat very differently all over the world for all meals. So I've decided I might add this sweet potato bean salad to my breakfast menu because it's a mix of everything good, sweet and satisfying and full of delicious things. The one thing it doesn't have in it is green food. Now there must always be hummus at any kind of gathering that you go to. It's like a saying that we like to say, at least there was hummus. When you go to an event and you never know if there's going to be food to eat, usually there's hummus, or hummus, as the traditionalists will call it. My beef with current day hummus is that it's not what hummus should be. Traditional hummus is made with garbanzo beans. That's what hummus means, garbanzo beans. And it's a garbanzo bean salad. So it's made with olive oil and lemon juice and a little sesame tahini, maybe some salt. And that's what hummus salad is. And it's blended up and it's creamy and it's yummy. Now we make all kinds of hummus spreads that aren't made with hummus. They're not made with garbanzo beans. They're made with other beans. And that's fine, but they're really bean spreads. They're not really hummus. But that's language and how we bastardize different words, change them up, make them mean what we want them to mean. My beef with hummus is that the most popular brands, like Sabra, for example, don't use olive oil. They use soybean oil. I believe it used to be genetically modified soybean oil. Maybe it isn't anymore. I haven't checked. I don't buy it. But it's not made with olive oil. It's made with preservatives and things that shouldn't be found in hummus. And hummus is the easiest thing that you can make. I particularly like it with fresh or roasted bell peppers. And I had a red one and a yellow one that I had saved just for the hummus, blended it up with some garbanzo beans, sesame tahini, and I don't use olive oil in my tahini. I rather just rely on the sesame seeds for the fat. And that makes it more of a whole food, just cooked garbanzo beans, sesame tahini, lemon juice, of course, and the bell pepper. I rarely salt my food, but I do add a little salt to the hummus. And that's that. I made one more dish, and that was vegan chopped liver. This was a recipe that my mother created, and it's been a tradition for my family for decades now. My mom used to make it, she said she wanted to make it for this event, and I knew that she wouldn't be up for it, so I made it. The secret is cooking everything slowly, and I know everybody's in a hurry, but there's a zen to taking your time and making dishes in a slow and steady fashion. It's even possible to do other things while you're preparing food. I know I'm doing 20 things at the same time. I was making all of these dishes kind of simultaneously, where I cooked the potatoes for the potato salad and for the sweet potato three bean salad. And while they were cooking, I started chopping and prepping other things. Things can go on at the same time. They don't have to be done serially. They can be done in parallel, and that saves time. The vegan chopped liver is made from three simple ingredients: yellow onion, fresh green beans, never frozen, and walnuts. And I chop the onions and cook them in a frying pan. You can use a little olive oil, or you can dry saute them, either or, and cook them slowly. Of course, if they start sticking, you can add a little water to the pan. The idea is to cook them slowly so that they caramelize, and this will take about 20 minutes. Some people you've seen in recipes, they cook the onions for 5-10 minutes, but that's not where you're going to get that beautiful sweet flavor, which is important in this recipe. So that took about 20 minutes. And then I added the fresh string beans, and I don't cover my saucepan, my frying pan. It's a high-walled frying pan that I use to keep everything in. But I find that if I cover it does cook faster, but it tends to take in a lot of its own steam and become soggy, and I don't want that. So I cook them slowly and wait for the green beans to be really cooked, and then add in the walnuts, toss them around, and then this whole dish gets pureed, and add a little salt to it to taste, and it's like the traditional Jewish chopped liver. Many people are surprised when they eat it because they say it's delicious and it looks like liver, and they might even be a little confused, but it's so much better. And you don't have to be Jewish or follow any kind of tradition to like this. You can call it a green bean pate, a green bean walnut pate. It is a wonderful appetizer. It's a great party dish. So I made that too. And then I was very lucky to have Gary, my partner, Gary DeMattei, on board making some of the other things. So I had requested that he make his tofu egg salad with his homemade mayonnaise. And we have that recipe at Responsible Eating and Living too. It's called the tofu no egg salad. And there's a secret ingredient in it: madras curry. We don't add a lot, just a little, and it really gives a dimension, a rich dimension, a complicated flavor to it that's very, very satisfying. And I was so delighted because my mom had ordered the classic egg salad made with eggs for this event, and she also had this tofu no egg salad, and she said she liked the tofu salad better. Not only was I thrilled that she liked it better, what's amusing to me is she and my dad used to always complain about food that had curry in it, and they would roll their nose up and say, no, they don't like curry. It's amusing to me because hot dogs, frankfurters, have cumin in them, which is the base of any curry, and my parents always liked hot dogs. But when you add certain spices in a subtle way so that their flavor is not overwhelming, it just kind of is a hint or a tickle. It kind of excites the tongue and the taste buds, and you're looking, what is that interesting flavor? But it's never overwhelming. And that's what this madras curry does in the tofu no egg salad. It's just a tickle, just enough, but it really enhances the flavor. Now, you can use a store-bought vegan mayonnaise, we have a recipe and a video on making mayonnaise. It's a really fun video, and if you haven't seen it, I recommend it. Gary's in it. Well, look for the tofu fumble. That was my favorite part of the video. But this particular mayonnaise, what I like about it is it doesn't have any sugar in it. And some mayonnaise, some vegan mayonnaise recipes do call for a sweetener. And I was making it with someone in mind who is not consuming any sugar at all. And so we used this homemade mayonnaise instead. And he had a lot of mayonnaise left over, which he made a ranch dressing with, which we also brought along to the event because we had a lot of crudité from carrots, celery, and red, orange, and yellow bell peppers. And this was a nice dip for it. Someone even put this dressing on top of my purple potato salad, and they said it was fantastic. My mom also wanted to have rye bread and pumpernickel bread. When I think of pumpernickel bread, I always think of my dad, who used to tell us a story when he used to work as a boy in a bakery. He used to tell us that they would take the cakes that hadn't been sold for the day and grind them up, and they would make pumpernickel bread from the cakes, which always sounded delightful and delicious to me. Bread made from cakes. I don't know how true that is, and I don't think that's how it's done anymore. Pumpernickel tends to be dark and has molasses in it. That's what makes it dark. My challenge was finding a bakery that made rye bread and pumpernickel. Where have all the bakeries gone, everybody? I don't eat bread, or I don't eat bread very often, and I'm out of touch. And I thought there must be a ton of bakeries here in my neighborhood in Forest Hills. There's a big Jewish community, and Jewish rye bread is a popular item. And I was like, where can I find them? And I Googled a bunch of bakeries, and nobody had it. What is that? Are people not eating bread? Are people getting their breads from supermarkets? I don't think it's because people are making their own. Fortunately, after some serious Googling, I did find one in the neighborhood where my mom lives, and they've been around for 2 years. Really nice little bakery, Emily's Bakehouse in Melville, and I picked up the rye bread and the pumpernickel. When I asked about the ingredients in the bread, this particular person who was at the counter was very knowledgeable, and the rye bread and pumpernickel breads are both vegan, which was nice. I had gone into a supermarket a few days before searching for bakery breads, and this one had a bakery in the supermarket. Many supermarkets have bakeries today, and I asked about their breads. They looked very good, very rustic. And I asked the person behind the counter if they had any breads made without milk or eggs, and she quickly went, oh, no, 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 no. Now, I don't know if I believe her. I don't think she was really aware of all the ingredients, but many fresh breads will have an egg wash on it. That's what makes the tops of them shiny. But a lot of breads aren't made with milk. They don't need to have milk in them or eggs. We know that, right? Now, one thing I was really grateful for. When we made these dishes and transported them to my mom's house and then brought home some of the leftovers back to our house, I was very grateful for our Pyrex dishes. We prepare foods and store them in mostly round Pyrex dishes that come with silicone covers. And if you haven't tried them, I highly recommend them. I have them in 1 cup sizes, 2 cup, 4 cup, and 7 cup. We also have some rectangular dishes that we use for baking and square ones for baking, and they also have the silicone covers on them. These are fantastic and so useful. We prepared all of our dishes at home and stored them in these Pyrex dishes, put them in the refrigerator. They stack great because you can use all the same shape and they can stack on top of each other. And then we easily transported them because they have these nice covers that fit tightly. They're sealed very well. And then we just took the covers off and put them out on the table, and they present themselves very nicely in these glass dishes. You don't need to find a new decorative bowl to put them in. The bowls they're in are fine. And then when we were all done, we just sealed up everything with the covers and brought them home and put them right back in the refrigerator. It was beautiful. We saved so much time in washing dishes and changing dishes out. These Pyrex dishes are genius, and you can cook in them, you can microwave in them. They are wonderful. I can't say enough about them. I know some people have complained from time to time that they have broken a Pyrex dish, putting them in the oven, for example. This has never happened to us. I don't want to jinx myself, but we've dropped a few, and they seem to be indestructible. That kind of wraps up all the food that we made for the party, and I'm not expecting anyone to go all out and make all of these dishes all at one time, but if you're having a party or an event, I think this is a great selection, and if you're up for it, go for it. You won't be disappointed. But maybe for a potluck or a picnic, you might want to try one of these recipes, and most of them you can find at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And if you can't, or you're having trouble, or you have any comments and questions, I'm here. You can always email me. I'm at info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org, or if you're at a particular recipe on the website and you have a question about it, sometimes I make typos and mistakes. I am not perfect. You can write a comment right there on the recipe, and I will respond as soon as I see it. Speaking of which, last week I talked about recipes with zucchini in it, and we got a few questions about some recipes with zucchini. I had mentioned making patties with zucchini, and I have made patties with just zucchini and onions, but I want to say it's not a recipe that I have posted because it's a very fragile thing, and it's not a or kind of recipe that everybody would want to make because it's challenging. You can saute your zucchini and your onions and make a patty out of them. Oh no, you don't saute them, but you can grate them, the onions and the zucchini. You can flavor them up any way you want. You can shape them in a patty and either bake them or fry them, but they're going to be very fragile, and it takes a lot of patience to lift them with a very thin spatula. So most of the recipes you'll see for the zucchini patty has a flour in them, and I've been playing with cornmeal and garbanzo bean flour and some others, and I promise I will be posting a zucchini patty recipe very soon. The other thing I wanted to talk about is beverages. So at this event, we needed to have beverages. Of course, we made coffee, and I had a bag of organic coffee beans in the freezer that I hadn't used for a while that I had gotten when I was in Costa Rica. So I ground them up, and I was able to make some coffee, and I couldn't believe how excited everybody was. Everybody wanted to drink coffee. I'm not a coffee drinker, but we had coffee. We had some sparkling waters and some orange juice and apple juice for the kids and for the grown-up kids. I really was trying to avoid buying soda, and my mom wanted to have ginger ale. So I broke down, I went to some local supermarket that I rarely step into, and thought I would get ginger ale. And when I think of ginger ale, I think of Canada Dry ginger ale. That's the ginger ale of my youth, of my upbringing, and I thought, okay, that's probably the best choice. What did Karen discover about ginger ale, Canada Dry ginger ale? Well, I was reading the ingredients on the label. It's just a bad habit that I have. And I was a little shocked. The ingredients in Canada Dry ginger ale, not only does it have a lot of sugar, and it's not even sugar, it's high fructose corn syrup. It contains carbonated water, high fructose corn syrup, citric acid, sodium benzoate, natural flavors, and caramel color. Now, if you listened to my show a few weeks ago, I talked about what natural flavors are, and it's scary. Natural flavors can be a lot of things that aren't necessarily natural. They can come from animals. They can come from a lot of places. So I'm always suspect when I see natural flavors. But it was the sodium benzoate that kind of turned my stomach, because I don't like to have preservatives in food. And then the other thing I was kind of curious about was, where's the ginger? This is ginger ale. It says on the label, made with real ginger, and yet it doesn't list ginger. And I was surprised and curious, and I did a little Googling, and sure enough, less than a month ago, there was an article in Forbes magazine, and it's about a woman from New York who is suing Dr. Pepper Snapple Group for the lack of ginger in their carbonated drink, Canada Dry, which advertises that it's made from real ginger. I'm not the only crazy woman from New York who discovered this. And she's suing them. The company says that real ginger is used to make the natural flavoring. But it's a flavor compound comprised predominantly of flavor extracts not derived from ginger and a minuscule amount of ginger flavor extract. And this particular woman was concerned because she knew that ginger would calm an upset stomach and wanted to give her children Canada Dry when they were sick, thinking it would soothe their stomach aches, but it doesn't have ginger in it. So there is that case, and I found that really amusing and very sad. And I'm thinking about ginger ale. How hard could it be to make a lightly sweet drink with ginger in it? And I'm tempted to do some at home. We make plenty of ginger teas. I don't know that I need it to be sweet, but it could be sweetened with a number of fresh fruits, for example, or dates. You can use whole foods to sweeten things without adding tons of sugar, like 9 to 12 teaspoons. And fresh ginger is wonderful. So I really want to try to make my own because I think it could be really yummy and fun. I ended up not buying the Canada Dry ginger ale. There was another brand. It's a local brand. And it had high fructose corn syrup in it, but it didn't have sodium benzoate. So I grabbed that and I thought it was the lesser of two evils. There are a variety of ginger ales that are made with more natural ingredients. I'm looking at one by Q Drinks, which contains carbonated water, organic agave, citric acid, ginger extract, extracts of coriander, cardamom, chili pepper, orange, and rose oil. Now that sounds like a fun drink. Another more traditional soda that I remember from my youth that my grandfather used to drink, and maybe my dad, but mostly my grandfather, was a soda called Celery. And this was a celery flavored soda. Have you heard of Celery? It's hard to find, and there are some pockets like Jewish delis, for example, that sell it. But I was thinking, what a great drink. Celery is such a nutritious food. Adding a little carbonation to it, a little carbonated water, it would be delicious and refreshing. So I wanted to check out Dr. Brown's Celery Soda. That was the popular brand, and there were some other non-recognizable label brands for Celery Soda back in the day when it was more popular. But Dr. Brown's Celery Soda is made with carbonated water, high fructose corn syrup, citric acid, extract of celery seed, and other natural flavors, sodium benzoate, and caramel color. What is it with sodium benzoate and high fructose corn syrup? Now, I don't know if Dr. Brown's original recipe contained those ingredients. Probably not, because high fructose corn syrup, I think, came about after the celery soda originally appeared on supermarket shelves and store shelves. And I don't know if the sodium benzoate is a new ingredient or a more recent addition, but it's sad. You can find recipes to make your own celery soda. And this is another one that I'm adding to my list of things to do. So the traditional celery soda is made with a celery syrup. Can you say celery soda, celery syrup? Fast, three times, celery syrup, celery syrup, celery syrup. I need to work on that. But it's actually made from freshly crushed celery seed. We have a lot of celery seed. We don't use it very often, and I'm thinking if I crushed it and made it a syrup from it, it might be fun. The recipes often call for a lot of sugar to make this celery syrup. That's why it's a syrup. And it's cooked with the celery seed. And then once you've made the syrup, you can jar it and then use it when you want in your drinks. But I'm kind of curious about celery soda. Have you ever had a natural celery soda? I have a juicer, and I'm thinking just celery juice with some sparkling water might be a fun drink to make, and so good for you. Celery is loaded with minerals, electrolytes. It's better than Gatorade. Okay, so that sums up what we did this week preparing for my dad's unveiling, and that's done. And we are moving on with our lives and our food. And now I just want to turn to some interesting things I saw in the news this week. Have you heard about vegetarian bears? I just read an article in Science Daily that there is a cave bear, a direct ancestor of the Denninger's bear, and they are believed to have been vegetarian or consuming mostly plant foods. And this is kind of fascinating. You might go to Science Daily to read about it, but somehow I like the image of the lion lying down with the lamb in the biblical verses. And I would like to think that maybe someday all the animal species on this planet will learn to consume plant foods and be sustained on plant foods rather than having to eat other animal species. So it's kind of curious to see that once upon a time there was a bear that survived on plant foods, that lived on plant foods, a vegetarian diet. Now, of course, all the omnivores out there will say, yeah, but they didn't survive. They're not here today. They got wiped out. And that's a valid point. But there are many big animals today, big, muscly, beefy animals, gorillas and elephants and rhinoceros, that get to their big, muscly size by eating leaves, by eating plants. Here's a good study that was recently published. I saw it in the Public Library of Science, PLOS.org, published on August 8th, and it's entitled Global Land Use Implications of Dietary Trends. And the authors seem to be from a variety of Canadian universities. I just want to read the abstract to you and then talk about it a little bit. So here's the abstract. Global food security and agricultural land management represent two urgent and intimately related challenges that humans must face. We quantify the changes in the global agriculture land footprint if the world were to adhere to the dietary guidelines put forth by the United States Department of Agriculture, while accounting for the land use change incurred by import-export required to meet those guidelines. We analyze data at country, continental, and global levels. USDA guidelines are viewed as an improvement on the current land-intensive diet of the average American, but despite this, our results show that global adherence to the guidelines would require 1 gigahectare of additional land, roughly the size of Canada, under current agricultural practice. The results also show a strong divide between Eastern and Western hemispheres, with many Western hemisphere countries showing net land sparing. under a USDA guideline diet, while many Eastern Hemisphere countries show net land use increase under a USDA guideline diet. We conclude that national dietary guidelines should be developed using not just health, but also global land use and equity as criteria, because global lands are a limited resource, national dietary guidelines also need to be coordinated internationally in much the same way greenhouse gas emissions are increasingly coordinated. This is a very interesting abstract. I agree with the statements. I don't think we have a forward-thinking government that could take these things into consideration. I remember the big controversy of just wanting to include environmental factors when putting together health guidelines for this country. But what I thought was humorous to me was the fact that they figured out that if everyone were to eat the way people eat in America on the standard American diet, I guess meeting the USDA guidelines, we would need an entire country of Canada to grow that food. It's not a difficult thing to figure out if you realize how much it takes to grow one cow and how much land it needs to grow the food to feed that cow. And if you figure out if the whole world was eating the amount of beef and chicken and pork that Americans are eating today, you quickly see that there is not enough landmass to do that. It doesn't take a big scientific study published in the Public Library of Science to figure that out. You could do it on a napkin. But it's an important point. We don't have the landmass to grow animals to feed an entire human population that's growing 7.5 billion, 8 billion, 9 billion, eating this way, eating primarily animal foods. And there are more countries that are starting to include more animal foods in their diet, and we just don't have the landmass to support that. We don't have the landmass to support it, and also it's creating a very toxic environment. And it's affecting our climate, as we're seeing more and more. I'm just wondering when we'll get the news that we can't eat this way. And please keep in mind, for those of you who are becoming more aware of what you're eating, you're transitioning to eating more plant foods, you're becoming more aware of the horrific way animals are raised today for food, you're becoming more aware of factory farms and CAFOs, confined animal feedlot operations. These are horrific current day human inventions to intensify the way we grow animals for food, keeping them in a very cramped environment, closed up away from the natural environment, growing in their own excrement and filth, creating mountains of excrement and filth outdoors that are affecting air quality of the local neighborhoods and water quality. So as you learn this and you still want to consume animal products, you might consider what's considered humane raising of animals, where animals are free to roam and graze. And this is a better solution to factory farming and confined animal feedlots. I will admit that. Personally, I don't think any animals should be consumed for food or their products, because I don't want to exploit those animals. I don't want to cause them any pain and suffering. I want them to have a space to live in, a wild life area where they can roam about, raise their families, and live as nature intended. But for those that are trying to bridge this problem with wanting to consume animals but not wanting them to live in a confined, unpleasant environment, they will go to humane agriculture. And keep in mind that that takes a lot more land. So I'm not sure what the calculations were based on. They say they were based on the USDA guidelines, and that probably includes factory farming. But if we were to feed everyone on this planet, the quantity of animal foods that people eat in the United States and in other Western nations, we would need another planet, and we don't have it. So that's just for you to think about if you're choosing animals and animal products grown either with a certified organic label or free range, which I say with hashtags, with quotes, air quotes, because there's no definition for that. There's no regulation for it. So you really don't know what you're getting when you see it. It's really not a good solution. The solution that I recommend here on It's All About Food, Karen Hartglass, vegan for 30 years, is an all plant diet and as much organic as possible. This is the kindest on the environment. It's the kindest to the animals, and it's also very nice in your belly. I want to talk about one more study before I go. There are so many studies on soy in the medical literature, in the science literature. And overwhelmingly, soy is always shown to have health benefits and can be part of a health-promoting diet. Soy, minimally processed soy, like tofu, tempeh, edamame, soy milk, miso, these are healthy foods and can be part of a health-promoting diet. Now, it's not necessary that humans consume soy. If you have an aversion to soy, if you have an allergy to soy, this planet is rich with plant foods that can nourish you. So you don't have to eat soy. But soy is a fun food to eat. And there's so much fear and mythology on the internet about soy. But if you search the medical literature, if you search the science literature about soy, you'll see that overwhelmingly, soy is protective. There are some studies that show that soy can be dangerous. I haven't seen them, but you have to look at the studies and see who they've been done on. Many studies are done on animals. Many studies are done in such a way that they can kind of predict an outcome. I don't particularly care for studies that are done on animals, but I just wanted to bring up a new one and talk about it briefly. It's in the Science Direct, sciencedirect.com. And here's the title and abstract. So it says, soy protein improves tibial whole bone and tissue level biomechanical properties in ovariectomized and ovary intact, low-fit female rats. That's a mouthful, isn't it? It's amazing what people will study these days. Scary, actually. Osteoporosis and related fractures, decreased physical activity, and metabolic dysfunction are serious health concerns for postmenopausal women. Soy protein might counter the negative effects of menopause on bone and metabolic health due to the additive or synergistic effects of its bioactive components. Now, this is a study that used rats and came out with a positive outcome regarding soy. It's soy protein, probably an over-processed soy protein, but it's a positive outcome, but it also can be a confusing outcome. And I just wanted to bring it up because there's all kinds of crazy science reports that come out all the time. Here's what we know. We know, as I mentioned before, that minimally processed soy foods can be part of a health-promoting diet. And the best way to have healthy bones is to have weight-bearing exercise. So I'm imagining that people who did this study or want to use this study are looking for ways to give people something in a pill or a powder. And I'm not against soy foods. I'm against not thinking sensibly. The best way to build bone, and you can build bone as an older person, an older woman, a menopausal woman. There are some little studies that have shown that weight-bearing exercise consistently done can help improve bone density. But the secret is exercise. Things like yoga, not just weight-bearing exercise, but things that help you keep your balance. We all fall in life. The secret is to fall, if you're going to fall, in a way where you don't break your bones. So with yoga, for example, you learn how to balance your body. You learn how to move with your body, and you learn how to fall instinctively. Because there are different poses where you're moving around and jumping around, and you have a greater sense of your center of gravity. This is what helps prevent fractures. Building muscle, toning muscle, weight-bearing exercise that improve bone density, they work together. You will have healthy bones if you have healthy muscles. You can't have one without another. You can't take a pill to improve your bone density if you're not going to have any muscle to support that bone. I also want to put out to the universe, to the global consciousness, an apology to the low-fit female rats that were used in this particular study. I know a lot of mice, a lot of rats are used in science studies. And it's an unfortunate thing that we do as humans, especially with things we already have the answers for. But that's what we do. And I'm here, Karen Hartglass, co-founder of Responsible Eating and Living and host of this show, It's All About Food. And what I'm here to do is help anyone who is interested in moving to a plant-based diet, a vegan diet, a whole foods, minimally processed way of eating and lifestyle, reducing the amount of exploitation we might cause to other beings on this planet and making it yummy and delicious. That's what I'm here for. So thanks for listening. Thanks for joining me today. And I hope you have a very delicious week. Thank you.